From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. As of Tuesday morning, the narrative was so easy to digest. Barack Obama's string of 11 straight primary victories had turned erstwhile frontrunner Hillary Clinton into a tragic, desperate figure who should, for the good of her party, be prepared immediately after the Texas and Ohio vote tallies to concede the race. But then Clinton screwed up the narrative by beating Barack Obama in Texas and trouncing him in Ohio. She didn't collect enough delegates to put her ahead of Obama, but she earned something ever so much more valuable, momentum.
Today it was all about momentum for Senator Clinton, so much so that she could finally do something she hasn't done in a long time, take a nap.
He's certainly still the front runner, no question. But she has the momentum today, and she takes that with her to Pennsylvania.
Positive last night after Hillary Clinton reeled off three straight wins in Ohio, Texas, and Rhode Island. So who's got the momentum now?
You know momentum. That's what Clinton had as the prohibitive Democratic favorite until the Iowa caucuses. But then she lost it to Obama, who was supposed to ride the Big Mo into a New Hampshire primary victory, but failed to do that, giving the momentum right back to Clinton, who was to use it to sweep up delegates on Super Duper Tuesday. Except that she didn't, surrendering momentum once again to Obama, who was all but declared the nominee by the media until Tuesday's Texas voting, and, well, you know. Suddenly, the narrative isn't so easy to follow. Tim Noah is senior writer at Slate, and he says enough already with this momentum talk.
The idea of momentum is very hard to define and, in some degrees, is invented out of thin air. For example, after Super Tuesday, most political experts, including a lot of political reporters, said you're going to see a streak of wins for Obama in a number of primary states where he has an advantage. And then you're going to have primaries in Ohio and Texas, and Hillary Clinton will probably win those. These predictions were realized over the last month. He did win those primaries, but then reporters acted surprised that he won those primaries.
Okay, now that may in some instances be true, but it seems to me it's equally true that going into Texas and Ohio, in the pre-election polls at least, Hillary Clinton had lost double-digit leads. And Obama, having come off a string of 11 straight primary victories, was viewed as an unstoppable force. And there was a lot of reporting about when exactly it is that Hillary Clinton should bow out of the race. And then she shows up and, you know, wins pretty big, especially in Ohio.
Yes, things did tighten up a bit. Obama did close the gap, at least in Texas. But you have to ask yourself, to what extent are we talking about momentum that's the product of anything other than the press talking up events that they knew were likely in the first place?
It has become clear that neither Clinton nor Obama can conceivably accumulate enough delegates between now and the convention to go into the convention with the nomination locked up. Hillary Clinton will claim, and has already started doing so, that she has the momentum to carry the party into the general election, and that even if she has fewer total delegates, that she deserves the nod. Does that accurately describe how the idea of momentum is being co-opted by the candidates themselves?
Well, yes, but it seems to me by now we've been burned three times in trying to figure out who had the momentum. I think it's time we all threw up our hands and said, momentum doesn't really seem to be a force here. We should just see who ends up getting the most delegates.
So doesn't this put into very sharp relief the entire problem of covering a political race as if it were a horse race? The media as a group have been so bad at prognosticating this cycle. Do you think they will be chastened and just cover each primary and caucus as a discrete element in the future as opposed to, you know, trying to weave it into a larger narrative?
Well, they might, but they're a bit like alcoholics who have a hard time swearing off the bottle. Narrative is just such an important part of journalism, and it's so much more compelling than arithmetic. It's also what journalists are good at.
You know, maybe I'm poo-pooing the idea of momentum, but I guess, you know, it demonstrably has existed in the past. I'm thinking of 1968 when Robert F. Kennedy was late into the race, but was doing extremely well and seemed to have an enormous amount of momentum behind him before he was assassinated. Are there other examples when momentum has categorically been an important factor?
There are a number of examples. One that comes to mind is Ed Muskie in 1972, who actually didn't do too badly in the New Hampshire primary, but he didn't do as well as I think it was his campaign manager had predicted. You know, the thing about momentum is because it's intangible, you're never really sure how much of it is the voters responding to events and how much of it is voters responding to the coverage.
Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Tim Noah is a senior writer for Slate. You may not know it from the press coverage, but it's been a momentous week for John McCain, too. After his unsuccessful bid for the nomination in 2000, he is now the presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency. To get some insight into covering McCain over the long haul, we turn to the senator's hometown paper, the Arizona Republic, and there we hit a brick wall, or more to the point, a stone wall. Nobody there was permitted to speak to us about the Republic's notoriously contentious relationship with McCain. So we turn now to a reporter who's had more success than us, Michael Calderon, who covers media for Politico. Michael, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So why would a large newspaper suddenly clam up about its most important story subject? Why so touchy at the Arizona Republic?
I would attribute it to being that the Arizona Republic is actually on better ground with McCain these days than probably just about any time in the last 18 years. And it could be because of that that the paper doesn't want to shake things up.
Now, the relationship goes back a long time since McCain first ran for public office. There were allegations that he was a carpetbagger.
That was really one of the first true political tests for McCain. Very famously, in one of the debates, he quashed that allegation, essentially saying that being a Navy man for several generations, that he's accustomed to traveling, and the longest he's ever lived in one place was at the Hanoi Hilton. And it was a very powerful statement. You know, it really reverberated in the press and kind of put that issue to rest in a lot of ways.
It was one of the more amazing comebacks in American political history, a response that began with, "Listen, pal."
Yeah.
And it was also the public's maybe first glimpse at his supposed volcanic temper. But the relationship got still worse between McCain and the Republic during the course of the Keating Five scandal, when the senator had to answer allegations that he used his influence improperly to help a political supporter, Charles Keating, in the midst of the savings and loan debacle.
For quite a while into the scandal, McCain had repeatedly said he didn't have much dealings with Keating. And it was actually two Arizona Republic reporters who reported in October of 1989 that Cindy McCain and her father had invested in a shopping mall with Keating. And then there were a few subsequent articles about trips to the Bahamas with Keating. And it was those articles that McCain basically got into shouting matches with the reporters, called them liars. But I spoke with Andy Hall, who was one of the reporters on the story. He had told me that at one point, John McCain said, "This is the worst moment of my life." And Andy Hall said to him, "You know, with all due respect, wouldn't being imprisoned in Hanoi for 5.5 years be the worst moment of his life?" What Andy said to me was that McCain said, "Well, at least my captors had ethics."
But it didn't end there either, did it, Michael?
No, it certainly didn't. Because a few years later, it came out that Cindy McCain had been addicted to painkillers. Subsequently, it was revealed that some of these painkillers had come from a relief organization that Cindy had founded. And it led to a very harsh editorial cartoon in the Arizona Republic that had a crudely drawn Cindy McCain shaking a baby and demanding drugs. And it was exceptionally harsh, and understandably, Senator McCain voiced his criticism of the paper in public.
There was a genuinely bizarre episode in 1999 or 2000 involving singer Connie Stevens and a murdered man, a story that somehow managed to link John McCain into a very sordid affair. Can you tell me about that?
A man named Ron Bianchi was found dead in 2000, and the Arizona Republic was looking into the case. It was a very murky case because Bianchi had a number of different ties and had at some point been a journalist in Arizona And for years, he had spread this rumor that John McCain had an affair with Connie Stevens, the singer. So because he had always been telling this story about McCain, when he was murdered, the Republic started looking into the story again just to see if there was anything to it and found that there was nothing there. The reason the Republic reported on the Stevens and McCain rumor when they wrote a very strange piece about Bianchi's life and death was because investigators had questioned McCain and Stevens according to their reporting, so they thought that it was relevant to include. But understandably, John McCain, who is now running for president, was not very pleased with them publishing this information.
Over the past 8 years, McCain has been a genuine darling of the national media. But in the course of a campaign, inevitably, coverage is going to get tough and stories will come out that McCain doesn't like. We've already seen one example in the New York Times story about his relationship with a lobbyist. Do you think that the bloom is going to come off the rose inevitably between now and November?
To a certain extent, it has to. And that's due because reporters have always thrown around the term maverick and have always prided McCain because he does speak very frankly. He does speak on the record. He has made himself incredibly accessible to the national media since Keating, actually, which is ironically when relations soured more with the Republic. But at the same time, he's not the insurgent Republican. He's now the party's pretty much in his hands. And being the Republican establishment candidate now, even though he's always been fighting against the establishment in the eyes of many in the media, I think will lead to a bit more criticism.
Let me ask you one more thing, Michael. Obviously, the Republic is very concerned about its newly won detente with McCain in the campaign. Does this mean that we can expect the paper to be so cautious that it pulls punches, that it goes so easy on him that its reporting ceases to be relevant?
I wouldn't expect them to pull punches. There's a very good reporter now covering McCain, and as far as I'm being told by the Republic people, they're going to deploy resources, and although they are in good footing right now, you never know. If they get some scoop, it could all fall apart if they get something that McCain doesn't want.
Okay, Michael, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me on.
Michael Calderon is a media reporter at Politico, and his story on John McCain's relationship with the Arizona Republic will appear on Politico.com. After only 18 months as the head of National Public Radio, CEO Ken Stern stepped down on Thursday by, quote, mutual agreement with the 17-member board. Stern's ideas about the direction of public radio, including an aggressive push into digital media, met with resistance from influential member stations who pay annual dues to NPR. Karen Everhart is a senior editor of the public broadcasting newspaper Current. We called her at home not long after word broke of Stern's departure, and I asked her if she was surprised.
Well, I am surprised given NPR's announcement yesterday that they had completed a deal to buy a new building in the District of Columbia for their new headquarters, which had been a key focus of Ken Stern's work at NPR over the last few months.
And as the press release marking his departure points out, in his tenure, NPR's audience has doubled, and he leaves the network in what the press release described as very healthy financial condition. But he made some enemies along the way, and I wonder if you'd care to tell me, you know, who exactly had it in for him.
When I first came on the beat of covering public radio, which was just last spring, I was really surprised by the amount of dislike that people expressed about Ken Stern. And to me, it was really puzzling because he seemed like a really competent and smart guy. And I would ask people who have been involved in public radio for years, well, why is this? Why don't people like him? And one person said, you know, you just got to take into account that he was the COO for years and he took the tough stance in union negotiations and he just wasn't popular.
In his efforts to kind of drag public broadcasting kicking and screaming into the digital age, he's also made some controversial decisions, which some in the station community thought were high-handed or arrogant or something, but which left some bitter feelings.
Well, the things that were most evident to me were with this new online music service that NPR launched last fall, where some stations were invited to participate as sort of founding stations, and many others felt like they were being bypassed. NPR was inviting their listeners to tune out from their stations and to tune in to all these other stations on the Internet. And there were quite a few stations that were unhappy that they seemed to have been cut out of that opportunity.
Now, you could argue that the digital revolution eventually will render individual broadcast stations obsolete if they view themselves as simply providing music and news content over the air to local listeners, because that can all be done centrally via podcasts and online streaming. And one of the challenges facing public radio is to find a way for stations, who, by the way, raise most of the money, to continue to be relevant in the 21st century.
I think stations recognize the challenge they have, but they don't trust current NPR management to help them navigate it. I just covered an NPR board meeting in February where they presented the results of a recent member survey, and only 49% said that they thought that NPR management actively listened to their concerns. And I think there's a real split right now over this idea that NPR needs to become a multimedia organization, or whether it needs to really focus on its core service of delivering really solid radio journalism.
Comes now the tenure of Dennis Harsiger, who had been chairman of the board. He's leaving that post in order to be interim CEO while a national search for a replacement is conducted. What do you know about Harsiger, and what do you think we and the public radio broadcasting community can expect from his tenure, whatever length it turns out to be?
Dennis Harsiger is a really forward-looking station manager. He's been in the system for a very long time. He's really well-respected, and he really thinks a lot about digital technology and how it's going to affect media, and not just the stations, but large organizations such as PBS and NPR. He served on the PBS board for many years, too, and has been involved in many of their technological breakthroughs with program distribution. So I think that in a time when there's a lot of distrust about what's happening at NPR, at least among the stations, Dennis Harsiger is a person that people will trust to move them in the right direction, because he's tried to navigate through all these challenges himself as a station manager. Whenever a big CEO leaves in public broadcasting, there's always a debate, you know, well, is the next person going to be an insider or an outsider? And Ken Stern, in a way, was an insider because he'd been at NPR before, but he didn't come from the station community. And, you know, to a lot of people, having someone who's one of their colleagues, who's really respected and knows a lot of people, knows his way around, and thinks a lot about where things are headed, that can be just what they want.
Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Karen Everhart is the senior editor of Current. In the spirit of full disclosure, WNYC, the station that produces this show, is participating in NPR's digital music project. Making its way through the New York State legislature is a bill known as the Libel Terrorism Protection Act. If passed, the bill would limit what's known as libel tourism, which, in a nutshell, is when an aggrieved party files suit against a U.S. publisher or author, not here in the States, but, say, in Great Britain, where libel law is much friendlier to the plaintiff. Through the legal principle of comity, a victory in a foreign court can be enforced here at home. The Libel Terrorism Protection Act seeks to limit such enforcement. That explains the libel part of the bill, but what does it have to do with terrorism? Samuel Abadi is a longtime civil rights attorney and outspoken proponent of the bill. He joins me now. Sam, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very kindly.
Who are Rachel Ehrenfeld and Khalid bin Mahfouz?
Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld is an Israeli-American scholar of terrorism and counterterrorism who runs the American Center for Democracy, has been a professor at Columbia, New York University, and perhaps most importantly, one of the world's leading authorities on the financial roots and ties of terrorist organizations. Her latest book is called Funding Evil. In that book, she identifies Khalid bin Mahfouz, who is banker to the Saudi royal family, as a financier of terrorism, and specifically that through something called the Muwafaq, or Charitable Blessed Relief Foundation, that he transferred millions of dollars, all told about $74 million, to various terrorist groups, including Osama bin Laden.
All right. Now, Bin Mahfouz sued Ehrenfeld for libel, but not in the States. Rather, he filed the complaint in England.
Indeed.
Why did he do it that way?
Well, Bin Mahfouz lives in Saudi Arabia. Ehrenfeld lives in New York. Her book, which identifies him as a terrorist financier, was published by Basic Books here in the United States. And that book was not marketed in Saudi Arabia and was not marketed in Great Britain. So common sense, you would think, meant that he would have to sue where the book was published, that is where he was libeled. But in fact, he went to England and sued her there because 23 copies of the book were purchased over the Internet. Unlike in American courts, courts in England, Australia, Canada, the Commonwealth courts will assert jurisdiction in libel cases merely by contacts in cyberspace.
Now, apart from the question of jurisdiction, what is it about the way libel law is understood in those countries that makes it a friendlier climate for a suit such as Bin Mahfouz's?
In this country, whenever a plaintiff alleges an injury, typically the plaintiff has the burden of proving the harm. In England, however, if you sue for libel or slander, the words you claim are offensive are assumed to be false, and the defendant bears the burden of coming forward and proving that they are true.
Now, Ehrenfeld, knowing the differences between U.S. and English libel law, tried preemptively to get a U.S. court to issue what's called an upfront decision to prevent any future judgment from England from being enforced here.
Correct.
But the courts turned her down.
What Dr. Ehrenfeld did was refuse to recognize the jurisdiction of the British court simply because 23 copies of her book were ordered from Amazon. And instead, she brought a lawsuit against Bin Mahfouz here to declare that his English judgment was not enforceable here as repugnant to the free press provisions of the First Amendment. And the New York court dismissed the case, saying that Bin Mahfouz had insufficient ties to New York for our courts to assert jurisdiction over him.
And that's kind of a catch-22.
In England, they're willing to assert, you know, very tenuous jurisdiction over her. But here, he gets more protection because our courts won't assert jurisdiction over him.
Now, on the face of it, something called the Libel Terrorism Protection Act, while helping a plaintiff such as Ehrenfeld, could have some other far-reaching and fairly frightening implications if the decisions of foreign courts are not respected here. Am I wrong about that?
You're exactly right. We have an interest in comedy, but we also have an interest in protecting our own values. And in this case, our interest in protecting the First Amendment and the principles of free speech and a free press trump the interest in enforcing foreign judgments that don't meet our First Amendment standards.
It seems to me that the existence of libel suit-friendly countries like the United Kingdom could actually, you know, apart from doing harm to authors who have published, cause publishers to not publish things that are worthy of print just for fear of getting whacked with a giant lawsuit from wealthy Arabs or anyone else.
This has already happened. After Dr. Ehrenfeld's book, Funding Evil, was published, two scholars published a book called Alms for Jihad, in which Bin Mahfouz was also identified as a major terrorist financier. That book was published by Cambridge University Press, the oldest academic press in the world. And on the mere threat of libel litigation by Bin Mahfouz, Alms for Jihad was pulped. All the unsold copies were destroyed, and the British public was no longer allowed to have access to that book. So the real threat to our national security by libel tourism is not theoretical, but practical, and has already happened, as in that case.
Okay, fair enough. Although absent the document itself, that is the book, you know, we can't know whether the chilling effect in that case stymied some important work coming to light in the public, or whether it was actually defamatory and that England's fairly liberal view of libel actually saved someone from defamation or other kinds of harm.
I don't think it's just theoretical, and I think we do know. We know because Craig Unger's bestseller in this country, House of Bush, House of Saud, was watered down and had to be published under a different name in England because of fear of libel tourism. We know that Bin Mahfouz keeps a website boasting of his almost 40 litigations, and he's hardly alone. And most importantly, Dr. Ehrenfeld has been told that her newest works will not be published because of the impact of libel tourism.
Well, Sam, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Samuel Abedy, longtime criminal defense and civil rights lawyer, is now writing and teaching in New York City. Every now and then, we report on undercovered stories, Darfur, stealthy end runs around the Bill of Rights, that sort of thing. We also report on undercover stories, like the video of abused cattle caught by Humane Society moles inside a California slaughterhouse. But then there's a third category, under the covers stories.
While you're asleep, they get to work. They bite, then suck your blood.
Nasty bloodsuckers have invaded so many homes all across the city. Eyewitness News reporter Carolina Lead shows us the bed bug battle plan.
Every place you could think of. Doctor's offices, schools, judges' chambers, retail stores, massage therapists, offices,
subways, buses. The Tri-State bed bug epidemic is now attacking four-star hotels.
One woman has a warning tonight for travelers. She says, you're not safe anywhere.
Under the covers for sure, but also perhaps over covered. Yes, bed bugs are a problem. It's true that they'd virtually disappeared until a few years ago, and no one denies that having them in your home is physically and psychologically disturbing. But Washington Post staff writer David Siegel believes the problem doesn't quite match the hyperbolic coverage, and he joins us now to talk about bed bug panic. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, so what is the appeal of bed bugs to story editors?
There's no editor in the country that will turn down a bed bugs are back story. And the reason is that, first of all, it's a real trend. It actually is happening. That always helps. Secondly, as a villain, the bed bug is irresistible. It has this great Dickensian name brand recognition. It's like finding out that someone has scurvy. It seems like a problem from another age. And it also has that visceral quality that local TV loves. There's a problem and it's in your home and it could be hurting you right now in that tradition of, you know, your air conditioner could be killing your pets.
Okay, now, fair enough. But it's one thing for a story to be overblown and sort of another for a lot of different news organizations to notice it, creating, you know, a sort of sense of overkill when in fact it's just, you know, one story from a lot of different sources.
That's true. I mean, the problem with this story has always been that the stats on it are incredibly squishy. There's just never been a good academic study that has explained exactly how back the bed bugs really are. So every journalist and almost every story that you see relies on one stat over and over again, and that is the number of calls to exterminators. And there's a couple problems with this. The first one is that it's always tricky to get a sense of the scale of any problem from a party that has a financial interest if that problem gets worse. It creates at minimum the appearance of a conflict of interest. The other problem is that there are so many people who think that they have an infestation of bugs and are being eaten by bugs that psychologists have a name for it. They call it delusional parasitosis. In New York City, there were 2,500 complaints to the housing authority in the last few years about bed bugs. And they check out every one of them, and 500 turn out to be real. So you have, it seems, two or three people who think they have a bed bug infestation and don't for every one that does.
So what you're describing is literally a form of hysteria. But is the coverage itself hysterical? I mean, give me some examples of what you think has been, genuinely hyperbolic.
New York City has really delivered on the bed bug hyperbole. This is really the bed bug capital of the world. The Daily News, for instance, they're tiny, evil, and everywhere in the city. Why bed bugs are on a tear from Park Avenue to the projects. The USA Today, they're back for a snack. It's easy to say don't let the bed bugs bite until the paranoia-inducing, blood-sucking parasites shake you awake. And finally, the New York Times, which generally doesn't traffic in hyperbole, bed bugs are back and spreading through New York City like a swarm of locusts on a lush field of wheat.
In our news meeting, we compared the bed bug stories to shark attack stories that periodically spring up.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually make a different analogy to stories about the recession. How does that go?
I think they're both examples of how writing about a story and having readers read about a story, consume a story in vast quantities, exacerbates the thing that's being written about. When economists try to figure out whether or not we really are in a recession, one of the things they want to know is how people feel about it and whether people think that we're headed towards a recession. Because if they think that we are headed toward a recession, they'll stop spending money. So there's this incredible amount of coverage. How could you not now think that we're headed toward a recession? In the same way, reading about bedbugs has had the effect of making more people think that they have bedbugs. I mean, everyone who reads about bedbugs double checks their beds to figure out whether or not they have the problem. And a certain percent of those people think they do and call exterminators. And that just generates more stories and more phone calls to more exterminators.
Have you gotten any kind of backlash over this piece at all? Have people who actually been bitten by real live bedbugs called you and told you how dare you or anything like that?
A lot. I've had I've had a ton of email from people who hope that I get bedbugs, who have had bedbugs, who say, you have no idea what you're talking about. It's a total horror. And the more coverage about this, the better. And I'm just waiting for the highly ironic infestation to begin in my own home.
Well, I certainly hope you are spared the pestilence. David, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
David Siegel writes for the Washington Post Style section. He's based in New York. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. In response to our coverage of broadcast TV's imminent digital conversion, admitted Luddite James Lewis of Baltimore told us that all three of his antiquated TVs will need conversion boxes. He wrote, quote, "What am I expected to do? I feel like I'm being forced unfairly into purchasing something that I have never needed. Not only that, but the government, who forced me into this dilemma, only provides for two conversion boxes. Totally unfair." Listener Jim Deal, on the other hand, enthused, quote, "I just got a digital converter box. Wow, I live in Vermont and received my TV signals through rabbit ears on top of my entertainment center. I felt pretty lucky that I got four stations, and with some antenna fiddling, I could see the pictures. Now I receive 12 stations with no fiddling." In response to our remembrance of William F. Buckley Jr., who died last week, Michael James Hill of Milwaukee wrote, quote, "Your comment on WFB is very disappointing. To in any way associate Buckley's work with the likes of Rush Limbaugh and his ilk is sad. Buckley engaged liberals in debate and had a long record of showing them respect. Liberals should miss WFB and his intelligent challenges, and without your sarcasm." On a lighter note, Aaron Harvey of Los Angeles disputed our claim that The Smurfs was the first animated television show based on a toy. Quote, "The cartoon Hot Wheels originally aired September 6, 1969 to September 4, 1971 on ABC and was based on the Hot Wheels cars of sponsor Mattel Toys. Thanks for your comments. Keep them coming to onthemedia.org or onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please tell us your first and last names and where you live. Dungeons & Dragons co-creator Gary Gygax died this week. The fantasy role-playing game known simply as D&D was first released in 1974 and is still being played today in a completely new gaming and social networking landscape that it helped to shape. Over the years, it's been accused of inspiring psychosis and witchcraft as well as being the pastime of geeks. I'm talking true nerds, and Time magazine columnist and admitted D&D player James Poniewozik makes no bones about that.
It was fair when I played it. It was certainly fair of me at the time, but it's probably not fair to say that anymore. Role-playing games are things that popular and unpopular kids play now. It's sort of the dominant mode of the culture. You know, as we know from the whole dot-com boom, from the success of Bill Gates, from, you know, all these different factors, there's kind of a pride in dorkiness that certainly didn't exist back when, you know, I was rolling my 20-sided dice when I was 12 years old.
When you played D&D, what was your name and what species were you?
I had a bunch of different characters, but the one I remember that I had for a long time was Giles the Paladin. He was a sort of like a magical religious fighter.
And how did you prosper in the game? I mean, are there winners and losers?
you don't win or lose the game, but you can get killed or not get killed. Like in, you know, a lot of video games, you don't really prosper by quote-unquote winning or losing games, but by advancing your character so that they get more experience and more abilities and more treasure and just stuff. Oh, I remember my weapon, too. I had a magical halberd.
You had a who?
Halberd is a kind of long pole axe with a pointy thing at the end of it. You learned a tremendous amount about medieval weaponry playing D&D.
What about women? They don't seem to haunt Dungeons & Dragons or these other modern role-playing games. Is that my imagination, or is this substantially a guy thing?
Again, I think back when I played it, it was much more a guy thing. You know, I knew a few girl D&Ders, but it was something that was definitely geared more toward a male kind of escapism. And just as it's not as exclusively dorky as it used to be, I also think it's not as exclusively male. You know, I do think that the whole culture of gaming and the descendants of D&D are a little more broadly women-friendly than they used to be.
One thing I remember is a bunch of stories about Dungeons & Dragons fantasies going too far and parents terrified and outraged about what their children were doing. Does it have some sort of darkness to its legacy?
Dungeons & Dragons was one of the antecedents of a lot of the cultural boogeymen that we see nowadays. And much like later on we learned that Marilyn Manson or rap music or violent video games would do horrible things to you, back then, Dungeons & Dragons was supposedly this satanic, obsessive, addictive game that would make you go crazy and make you a permanent bachelor.
So let's talk about the effect Dungeons & Dragons had on today's fantasy role-playing games.
Well, one of the most popular role-playing video games nowadays is World of Warcraft, which is sort of a networked social analog to Dungeons & Dragons, in which, likewise, you play characters and acquire weapons and acquire treasure and so forth. Even in a broader sense, a lot of games that are played nowadays involve some kind of social aspect or imaginative role-playing aspect. Even, you know, non-violent, non-fantasy games like, say, The Sims. What Dungeons & Dragons and its associates spawned was this whole idea that games were kind of more fun when they were open-ended and you could play roles and interact with other people.
Now, in addition to games, the D&D culture has also seeped into more mainstream content like TV shows. Tell me which shows you think are direct beneficiaries of the culture that Gary Gygax cultivated.
Case one on TV nowadays has to be Lost, whose producers have said that they themselves have been very influenced by video games and role-playing games. And to use, you know, one of those useful SAT analogies, Lost is to a show like The Fugitive what D&D was to a game like Monopoly, which is to say that this whole trend in popular culture nowadays, which spawned largely from D&D and things like that, is that interactivity and sprawling narrative and the ability to go down rabbit holes and digress and so on is just much more appealing now than stories and games that are strictly linear, sort of, you know, handed down to you top-down. So, you know, the experience of watching Lost on TV and then immersing yourself in the culture of Lost through the associated games and websites and so on is very much like the immersive experience of playing D&D as opposed to just, you know, opening a game in a box and playing it for, you know, an hour on a rainy afternoon.
All anticipated by Gary Gygax, you know, by three decades. That sounds to me like the ultimate case of Revenge of the Nerds.
Absolutely, and that is the story of our lives.
James, as always, thank you very much.
Oh, sure, thank you.
James Poniewozik writes Time Magazine's Tuned In column. Gary Gygax, co-creator of Dungeons & Dragons, died this week at age 69. Last weekend at the Brooklyn Bridge Marriott in New York City, 23-year-old crossword puzzle phenom Tyler Hinman bested solvers from around the country to win the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament for the fourth straight year. Among his competitors was Brooklyn's own Stella Daly. On the media producer Mike Volo followed Daly to the tournament in 2006 and came back with this report. Mike knows whereof he speaks. He is himself an avid crossword solver and even a constructor, someone who writes puzzles.
It's true. So I could empathize with contestant Stella Daly, who in the lead up to the tournament was struggling for equilibrium.
I won't say I'll be disappointed if I don't win, but I think I'd be a little bit, I would be a little bit disappointed in myself.
Daly happened upon crossword puzzles back in 1998 while a junior at Princeton University. She wasn't a speed solver back then. It would take her an entire day to finish the New York Times Sunday crossword, and just finishing it was enough. Then in 2001, Daly stumbled on a website for the tournament. She had gotten faster by then, a lot faster. So she thought,
hey, this is great, a crossword tournament, I should go. And of course they have on the website a puzzle from the tournament and they say, if you can solve this in under 15 minutes, you'd be competitive at the tournament. And if you solve in under 10 minutes, that's excellent. So I solved it in like 9:45 and I thought I was the bomb and I was going to go and do great.
What Daly didn't realize is that 15 minutes would be no gauge of greatness at the tournament. In fact, for some rounds, 15 minutes is all you get.
In order to be competitive, as in the top 10 at the tournament, you better solve that puzzle in 3 to 4 minutes. So I was completely embarrassed. My first finish was 220th out of 330, and I'm a really competitive person, and I was really pissed off by that. So I decided that was never going to happen to me again.
Daly started solving the New York Times puzzle every day, and the following year at the tournament, she placed in the 170s. Then she upped her regimen to several puzzles a day from newspapers around the country, and in 2004, she jumped to 39th in the rankings. Last year, with more than 450 solvers in the tournament, Stella Daly finished 6th. Now at home in Brooklyn Heights, less than a week before the big event, she's doing 20 puzzles a day.
Ferocious Fishy is a piranha. Assume 6 letters, blank, 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 E-O, blank. I'm guessing that's take on. Name from Woody's past. Oh, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, MIA. 115 across. Senator Sam is
I am sitting here doing the Sunday Times crossword puzzle. Somehow the words won't come. I am staring at squares, but my eyes never focus and my mind's feeling strangely numb.
The very first crossword was published in the Pulitzer-owned New York World in 1913. As the story goes, the paper's Fun Pages editor, Arthur Wynn, hailed a horse-drawn cab in Midtown and told the driver to take 42nd across and first down. And in that moment, the puzzle was born. New York Times puzzle editor Will Short says that crossword puzzles went quickly from local curiosity to national craze.
What caused that craze? It was partly the rising education level in the United States, I think. It was this wonderful mass distribution system of newspapers and a sense of fun of the 20s, you know, in the roaring 20s. And just within a matter of months, virtually every American newspaper started publishing a crossword.
Of course, the 1920s was a decade given to crazes. There was flagpole sitting and dance marathons, even imports like Mahjong. But for a brief time, says Shorts, crossword was king.
There was crossword jewelry. There was a show on Broadway called Puzzles of 1925, which one of the scenes was in a crossword puzzle sanitarium for solvers who had lost their minds. The B&O Railroad installed unabridged dictionaries for the convenience of its puzzle-loving passengers. So the country was just mad about crosswords for about 6 months.
One puzzle-themed hit from 1924 was titled Crossword Mama, You Puzzle Me, But Papa's Gonna Figure You Out.
You treat me like an orphan in a storm. Crossword books won't keep my tootsies warm. Crossword Mama, You Puzzle Me, But Papa's Gonna Figure You Out. Washington, he crossed the Delaware. Columbus crossed the ocean blue. If there's any more crossing to be done, Papa's gonna double-cross you.
So virtually every American newspaper had, by the 20s, been publishing a crossword. The sole holdout, the New York Times. On November 17, 1924, the Times dismissively asserted that solvers, quote, get nothing out of it except a primitive sort of mental exercise. Puzzle fan Louise Sinclair fired off a nimble riposte in the form of a letter to the editor. I cannot but believe, she wrote, that in this day of looking and listening, of movies and radio, a sport which demands a little thinking should not be utterly despised. The New York Times went on despising the crossword for another 18 years and finally ran its first one in 1942.
Crossword puzzles are really a soothing ritual.
Mark Romano is the author of Crossworld, One man's journey into America's crossword obsession.
For some people, it's a cocktail after work. For others, it's tea made a special way in the morning. So the crossword is a daily presence in my life.
You might guess that the fastest puzzle solvers are masters of words rather than numbers, but many of the best actually come from the math and science fields. You might also guess that a crossword puzzle tournament would be a sedate affair. Mark Romano.
One would expect that somebody who spends a significant amount of their time alone and doing a solitary activity would tend more toward the introvert on the introvert-extrovert emotional scale. So it's with a certain amount of trepidation that you approach your first tournament because you're thinking, my gosh, this is going to be the quietest, most boring thing in the world. Then you walk in through the lobby of the Stanford Marriott and it's like all hell is blown loose.
It's 8:30 on Sunday morning. Contestants solved six puzzles yesterday, which were graded for speed and accuracy overnight. The results have just been posted. Stella Daly, her hair still wet from a shower, wearing a Don't Mess with Brooklyn t-shirt, is pressed up against the lobby wall.
A little disappointed right now. Puzzle 5 just about, killed quite a lot of us, and me in particular. So I'm currently ranked in 12th place, even though yesterday I actually walked out of Puzzle 2 having finished it faster than anybody else.
After the seventh and final puzzle later that morning, Daly remained in 12th place, which makes it the first time she's ever moved down from one year to the next in the rankings. She'll shrug this one off and try again, the kind of determination shown not just by puzzle solvers, but also by puzzle constructors.
So let's see what we got here.
On the Friday after the tournament, Will Shortz picked up his mail at the New York Times. He receives about 75 submissions from puzzle constructors each week and sifts through them on the train ride back to his home in Westchester County.
Don't know this person. The acceptance rate for new people is extremely low, but, you never know, so I always hope for the best.
During his 13-year tenure as crossword editor, Shortz has published several hundred constructors, some frequently, some only once. Somewhere among that list of names is me. Over the years, I've gotten a few dozen crosswords into the New York and Los Angeles Times. My last puzzle was published in 2004 while in graduate school, which has a way of obliterating hobbies. But despite all that, I'm not sure I could be a contender at the tournament. Speed solving's just not for me. I like to take my time. In fact, unlike Stella Daly, I do it in bed.
I would see a lot of personal ads that said, I'm looking for a woman who wants to spend the day in bed with me, just like reading the New York Times and solving the Sunday crossword in bed. And I'm like, well, you probably shouldn't go out with me unless you want to feel really inadequate, because I'm going to sit there and I'm going to solve the New York Times Sunday in 10 minutes or less. And it's not leisurely to me at all.
Turns out curling up in bed with the Sunday Times is no longer an issue for Daly. In fact, she and Mark Romano and 40,000 other premium subscribers don't think of solving as attached to the physical product of the newspaper at all. Those solvers don't bother to grandstand by wielding a pen instead of a pencil. For them, solving the puzzle has already gone the way of the rest of the paper. Online. For On the Media, I'm Mike Vuolo.
For those of you keeping score at home, in a field of nearly 700 contestants this year, Stella Daly once again finished 12th.
Made me blue as can be. Broad crosswords between my sweetie and me. Every night in her little home, we sit together, but I'm all alone. I'm jealous, how can I win sympathy? I'm hoping she'll soon need L-O-V-E.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Folo, Mark Phillips, and Nasneen Rafsanjani. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zachary Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.